May it please the court. Mr. Swisher had the say no evil argument or portion. I have the hear no evil. I have hearing aids and sometimes I don't hear the court clearly.
If I jump out at you, and don't be startled.
Okay. With respect to Jose Luis Pidemota, the record in this case establishes that multiple witnesses testified multiple times about the same thing. It may not be precisely vouching in the sense of being extra record and things of that sort. And Judge Graber, you make a fine distinction with respect to the testimony. My recollection is the same as being somewhat different from my testimony would be the same. I'm not sure jurors make that same fine distinction when they hear somebody say it would be the same. In other words, what they're saying would be the same thing. We both saw it. It would be the same. And what I want to point you to on that is that, for example, with respect to one of the things that they talked about, they would expect to see a scale in the house. Three agents testified about that. It was Benick, Ostergaard, and Valadez. With respect to cutting agents and how they might be engaged in the house, Benick, Barda, Ostergaard, and Valadez testified to that. When you get to the issue of heat runs, and what's a heat run, Moritz, Barda, and Valadez testified to that. And let me call you
Are there any cases that suggest that there is a lack of entitlement on the part of the government to have several witnesses talk about the same thing?
I can't cite one off the top of my head to you. What I can tell you under 403B, it's going to be cumulative. But the point is, particularly here,
which is a discretionary call.
It is. But the point here is that this is coming out not so much in the terms of I saw the light and the light was red. I think when you talk about factual witnesses, that is different than when you talk about opinion testimony. And bear in mind, these witnesses were experts. There was no question about that. The government argued they were experts. It told the jury repeatedly they were experts, and they made their career, or this was their career for them. So that was an important aspect in it, and I believe that is sufficient enough to make a difference there. None of the cases that anybody has found so far involve more than two. You can go through and basically name each witness who testified as an expert. And here you start with Moritz, and you go through Valadez, or end with Valadez, and in between you've got the guy from Arkansas who talks about the highway and how he always stops and he always sees drugs and guns together, and Moritz has said that, and somebody else says that, and pretty soon, you know, everybody knows it.
Assuming that it's error, tell me why you think it's not harmless error.
Mr. Rawls did a good job of demonstrating through the testimony of Valadez, who was, I believe, the only person aside from Barda who was able to see the house where Jose Luis Pidemota was. He established through Valadez's testimony that there was nothing suspicious about the way Jose drove to or from the house. When he got out of the car, he didn't stop and look around to see if he was being followed. He didn't see him do anything that was suspicious in any way to do that. He also established that there were other people who had access to that house. Hernandez lived there. Hernandez was the one who actually produced the drugs. And while he had a small shed in the back where he stayed, there was no bathroom in that. And so he would naturally come into the house, the bathroom, where this cutting agent was found and things of that sort. This could have gone on without Jose Luis Pidemota's involvement in large part. All right? And that's why I think there is prejudice, and were this case retried in a different way, I think you're going to get a different result. And, you know, we've talked about the sweeping conclusions that some of these witnesses drew. They said that, you know, we always see guns that are being disassembled to be shipped to Mexico. These guns were rusty, they were old, they were parts. They wouldn't make a single gun. They couldn't shoot the ammunition, the 7.62 ammunition that they wanted to say they found that could have been used in them. Then they talk about, who was it, Benick, I think, talked about the fact that that this was a stash house. He would call it a stash house. Valadez said, no, I wouldn't call it a stash house. In another situation, one of the witnesses testified that the guns in the house, and the prosecutor made that same point here, the guns in the house were there for protection. Well, the jury acquitted on those counts. There were two guns in the house. They were in boxes, unloaded, and in a shelf with a bunch of other boxes on top of them in the bathroom. They were. One witness says they're there for protection. The next witness, and then when cross-examined, it's, well, if they're unloaded, they wouldn't be for protection, because I wouldn't carry an unloaded gun with me. So we have this whole panoply of experts coming in, and part of the problem is if you're successful attacking the first witness, they got Benick, they got Valadez, and they got Ostergaard. And Ostergaard, although he testified before Valadez, he's their cleanup hitter. They qualified him and had him testify as an expert. When I say qualified.
So how was all of this problem ever raised to the district court?
The issue was not well raised in the district court. There was a notice that was given by the prosecution that said they intended to call three witnesses, and they gave the briefest summary that they were going to testify modus operandi. At the start of the trial, I'm not sure what defense counsel expected of that notice, but it didn't sound or would not sound to me as a defense counsel.
The defense counsel must have also been aware at that point that these were percipient witnesses as well as modus operandi witnesses, right? I mean, they were at the events in question, at the arrest, and
yes,
right? So they were known. They were known to be percipient witnesses, and then the government said, and by the way, they're also going to testify as experts on something. So to follow up with Judge Schroeder's question, there was not an objection that it was improper for a witness to do both without employing mitigating procedures.
That's correct.
So we were reviewing for plain error.
You are.
Okay.
And what I would say on that is that in one instance they did get into the foundation of a witness to offer an opinion, and that was Ostergaard with respect to the comparison of the calls. And I think that was
the
voice identification, and I think that was a faulty issue or faulty comparison. But let me come back for just a second to this issue of the experts and the notice that they were going to be percipient witnesses. The government's notice said something to the effect that at the end, we're going to give you notice of this, that they're going to testify about these things, and to the extent that that is expert testimony, this is notice that we're going to use them as experts. So in its notice, the government was couching this as though it was sort of lay testimony.
Well, I think that what it sounds to me much more like, well, we're not sure if this counts as expert testimony, but assuming that a judge thinks so, here we are telling you about it. I mean, I don't understand why there's anything defective about the notice.
Well, the notice obviously is not as strong as it should be for the defense, and I would give you that. But the point of it is that if you contrast the conduct of the prosecution in closing argument with the position it took in that notice up front, by the time it got to closing argument, everybody was experts. And while he did not say three witnesses testified to this or four witnesses testified to this, he said repeatedly, the prosecution said repeatedly, the agents testified, the experts testified. You heard it from the agents and the experts. And so everybody was lumped together. It was plural. And that's part of the problem that we ran into in this particular case. It's really hard to marshal a defense. And if you look at it from the standpoint of, okay, let's say what they did was okay. The notice was sufficient to get you there. Then what's the standard going forward? Is it eight witnesses? Is it eight experts or four? And what are we telling the district judges they need to do about this situation?
Oh, it's tough, though, when there's no objection.
I understand
that. That's because you're arguing basically a sua sponte obligation to sort this stuff out. And if the first time the agent testifies in an expert manner, the defense counsel doesn't jump up and object, it's pretty tough for to fault the district court for allowing the testimony to proceed.
It starts with Moritz, and I'd have to take...
Or if you're even offering an instruction.
Right. The government gave notice that Moritz was going to testify, and Moritz is their first witness out of the box. And in terms of the defense posture, you've been given notice to some extent that Moritz is going to say some of these things. Now it comes along, and you get one of them, and... What do? Do you object and say he's not an expert and let the government go back through?
Yes.
And
I mean, that's a short answer, if you're going to preserve it for appeal. I mean, that's the problem, is that then you get into plain error, and then that's a... Well, our questions have taken you over your time, so thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
And we won't lose track of the other issues that you've briefed as well.
Thank you.
If I could begin by talking about the defense's statements about the closing argument that was given, and that the government did four times in closing argument say the word expert in respect to testimony, but it wasn't about all of the stuff that was garnered. There are four areas that the government specifically referred to. They said they talked about expert testimony with respect to roles in the offense, the various roles that Middleman played. That's at 629.10 at 1326. The agents and experts tell you that this is what they would expect driving around doing heat runs. So they referred to expert testimony with respect to heat runs. Government also talked about expert testimony, told you drug dealers aren't going to bring extra people to a drug deal. And that's at 1346, and that some activities were consistent with being a middleman, again, talking about role in the offense. So really the only thing that government talked about with respect to expert testimony, its closing argument was roles, counter-surveillance driving techniques, and whether someone would bring extra people, uninvited people, to a drug deal.
I think the defense has a pretty legitimate argument about this blending of lay percipient witness testimony and expert testimony. I think there's a great deal of problem or potential for prejudice in that kind of testimony, and here it goes all the way through the trial. I mean, you're saying, in your experience, does this happen? Yes, and this is a drug deal because this is a heat run.
Your Honor, as this court has set forth previously, there is a potential for prejudice, but I dispute that defense has pointed to any prejudice, and that some of the examples given were not truly expert testimony. We're not called expert testimony by the government, but they did rely on training
this?
And expertise.
Is there an active market for firearms parts that drug traffickers are involved in? Yes. Where? Mexico.
Yeah.
And so then you use parts, there's an active market, therefore they make the connection. And it's not subject to the same scrutiny that we would have for somebody who's just offering a purely expert opinion unconnected with the facts of the case.
Right, and I love that you picked that example, because that's an example where there was no prejudice, because defense, as they're supposed to in cross-examination,
well, sure,
took that apart. The things that they pointed to, one witness testified about a stash house based upon his training experience. They effectively took that apart during cross-examination of another government witness. Counterfeit currency was another thing that they talked about.
You can't really rely on the strength of the cross-examination to say there's no prejudice. I mean,
I think you can, Your Honor, and I think that's what this court's cases have said. Reed, in specific, just let me check my notes and make sure I'm...
Well, I take your point, but I mean, solely, I mean, if you have to rely on the cross-examination to say there's no prejudice, you're getting close to prejudice.
Right, but I would say that there are ways to carry it. One would be an objection if the defense thought that the evidence was harmful. If they didn't object, there were four defense attorneys here, and none of them objected to any of this evidence. And I contend that that's because it wasn't that egregious, as the briefs make it seem. If you read the transcript as a whole, these are isolated incidents. A lot of them were things like a scale is consistent with someone measuring drugs. It doesn't require a Daubert hearing to establish that. This court has said that guns and scales and things like that are consistent with drug trafficking. So some of the examples they cite to are legitimate examples of where we used expert testimony, and others I just will respectfully disagree. The court did not conduct did not give its imprimatur to these witnesses either. Specifically, the instruction did not refer to them as experts. The instruction only said you've heard opinion testimony. So the only person who was calling them experts was, unfortunately, me.
Nothing's happened in closing.
Yes. And as I stated earlier, the four times when I referred to it as expert testimony were in very limited specific categories. The other times, there were three other times where the word expert appeared in the transcript, and it was twice where I said, you don't need experts to tell you this. Common sense tells you this.
How long was this trial?
5 days, Your Honor, I believe.
Would you mind, I think I understand your argument on the experts, and you had a chance to talk about that before. Would you mind talking about the Bruton argument?
Yes, sure, Your Honor.
I know counsel didn't have a chance to get to that, but I think there's a point that he has on the Bruton, well, but Bruton slash Crawford issue.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that there was a Bruton issue here. A, they did not raise it. They specifically disclaimed any Bruton issue. Mm-hmm. Right before trial started, based upon the sanitized statement. And under Richardson, this is exactly what the Supreme Court has said is okay under Richardson, as long as you don't leave a blank, you don't put Mr. X. And the statement was carefully sanitized. I don't have it at hand. I should have made sure I had it right in front of me, and I apologize for that. But did not refer to others, did not refer to anyone else's involvement in the drug deal, even with a blank. And so therefore, I don't think there's any Bruton issue or Crawford issue in that regard, because there was nothing to him. And the court did instruct the jury to consider the evidence separately and not to use evidence for one defendant as to the other. One issue I would like to touch on, if I can.
Certainly.
If the court found that there was some error in the mixing of the expert testimony, the government strongly contends it's not plain, but more importantly, it's harmless. The evidence was overwhelming as to Mr. Jose Pitamota. The circumstances of the initial negotiation where Hernandez showed up at the deal, they talked on the phone, Agent Moritz heard his voice, they had conversations. He said, I would send somebody. I'm sorry, before Hernandez sat there, he talked with the CS in Moritz's presence, talked with Jose Pitamota. Jose Pitamota said, I'll send Jesse. Jesse showed up. Hernandez showed up. Agent Moritz made an identification of his voice. Agent Ostergaard listened to jail recordings. There was proper foundation laid for those to establish that they were Jose's voice on the jail recordings. And then identified that as being the same voice on the tape, so there were two witnesses in that regard. Plus, his behavior was extremely suspicious. His cars were used. Two of his vehicles were used in the transmission. I'm sorry, one of his vehicles was used, or at least registered in his wife's name, to transport the drugs. He met with the white car after the other four men, or the other two cars, had met with the white Honda previously. They all went into his house together. I think there was more than sufficient evidence to establish this defendant's involvement in the drug trade, separate and apart from any of the expert testimony. And I would like to also touch on Judge Graber's comments. The notice was sufficient to put them on notice. It didn't just list three. It listed three witnesses by name, but it said, including all ICE and our DEA and ICE agents, including without limitation these three men. The defense had ample opportunity to make us specify who we were going to call. They had ample opportunity to object during trial. They objected quite frequently on other grounds during trial. This was the type of issue that should have been handled, and to the extent there was any shortcoming in the notice, this court's case law says that that's not reversible error, that a Rule 16 discovery issue is not something that can be reversed.
When was the notice delivered? Refresh me.
Don't hold me to this, but I believe it was more than 30 days prior to trial, Your Honor. I'm almost certain. I could check if you'd like.
No, that's fine.
Unless there are any further questions, I will.
All right. Thank you very much. So the case of United States versus Jose Luis Pita Mota is submitted.